Teach Me to Code, episode 58. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. Sorry, I almost said screencast there. All right. Today we're going to be talking with Tyler Bai. Tyler is one of the guys that built the CBS iPad app. The iPad app was actually one that I think Steve Jobs took one look at it and said, yes, this is what the iPad was meant for. So anyway, we're going to talk to him about how they built it and you know, what all that means. But before we get going, I want to mention our sponsor. We have NewRelic.com. New Relic is the leading application management tool out there for Ruby on Rails applications. Honestly, it is an awesome application. Just gives you all kinds of great information for your Ruby or Rails or Java, or I think they got into .NET and PHP these days. I mean, they just do it all. So if you want to know how your application is performing, they are a great way of finding that out. So I highly recommend that you go check them out. You can find them at newrelic.com. And that's it. I'm going to do the rest of my announcements afterwards, so we'll just get into the interview here. Hey everybody, we're here with Tyler Bai. Tyler is an iPhone developer. The only thing I really know about him is that he built the ABC TV Networks iPhone or iPad app. So I'm going to go ahead and let him introduce himself, and then we'll get into the interview.
Thanks, Chuck. I'm Tyler Bai. I run a company called Protoven. We are the main iOS developers for ABC Television and do quite a bit of work for them. We did the ABC player for iPad, which has been fairly successful, a few million downloads, and continue to do some work with them. Our background is in streaming media, and we've also created an over-the-internet streaming service called Uplink. So those are the two main things that we work on currently.
All right, and I just want to point out that I did meet Tyler back at a launch up, which is kind of a what is it? It's kind of a barn raising. It's kind of the meme yeah. that they've chosen, but yeah, it's for startups.
It's kind of my take on it is it's a place for entrepreneurs, whether they're technical or not, to meet others that may supply resources that they might need.
Yeah. That's fair, and it seems like there's a huge leaning toward technological startups, but
yeah,
that's not necessarily what it's all about. It's about starting successful companies. So, I'm a little curious. How do you wind up working on something like ABC's iPad app? Because it's not like they just go, well, we need some guy out in Utah. And Tyler's a nice guy. Tyler, can you build it for us? I mean, how do you go about finding something like that?
Sure. It makes sense to give a little bit more background on Protoven. We're five guys, and all of us spent time at Move Networks. And in fact, my partner, a guy named Dave Bruick, was chief architect over there. So as we toiled through many nights and labored over there, we came to realize that a few of the guys were pretty great programmers. And that's how we chose our team. Well, while we were at Move Networks, which also had a streaming service, we did work for ABC. And then as Move Networks sort of went sideways and we knew that it was time to jump ship and go do our own thing, some of our former colleagues from Move were based out of the LA area and continued, you know, they joined other companies, and they continued to have discussions with ABC for their new companies. Well, during one of these meetings, they were told by ABC that they were looking for some iOS guys because they just didn't have the guys on staff. And this colleague of ours happened to drop our name and said, hey, these guys are available. They've been doing iOS stuff. You ought to give them a call. And the rest is history. They gave us about 3 weeks to do the iPad player without hardware, and we managed to pull it off. So,
Oh, that's right. I remember you mentioned that it was that you were building the application before the iPad came out.
Yeah, it's pretty funny because we would get on a call because of ABC's relationship and Disney's relationship with Apple. We would get on a call with some of the Apple engineers every week. They were actually getting a few of our builds so that they could test it because they knew we didn't have hardware. Well, it was getting down to the wire, and they said, well, we've sent you an iPad. And ABC saying, no, we don't have an iPad, you know, this digital group that we work with. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out Apple had sent ABC an iPad. Mm-hmm. The one they were talking about was the iPad that showed up on the episode of Modern Family when Phil got it for his birthday. So yes, they did send ABC an iPad, but we never got to test with it.
Oh, wow. That's funny. So it doesn't seem like your run-of-the-mill iOS application. It, you know, where you have a little game or it keeps track of your, you know, your friends on Facebook or whatever. I mean, you know, how different is it from just, you know, something that you would come up with just to track your calories or whatever?
It's quite a bit different. HLS, HTTP live streaming, is an adaptive streaming protocol that Apple has created the spec around, and they've issued that to the IETF, but it still has its hiccups. So really, ABC, you know, I hate to put words in their mouth, but they were fairly lucky to get guys like us who have such a strong background in adaptive streaming.
Right.
I mean, we created adaptive streaming at Move Networks. So we understood a lot of the issues they would run into with video playback. Uh-huh. You know, the iOS devices are new. The iPad is brand new, of course, when this app launched. But there are a lot of nuances inside of working with HLS that you would need a fairly strong streaming media background in order to even approach how to overcome some of those issues. So we do the look and feel and the interface and whatnot, but we did a lot. We gave them a lot of guidance on how they should set up their streaming and what encoding to do, etc. Uh-huh.
So it sounds like there's a lot of infrastructure on the back end to make it all work.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, to toot my own horn a little bit, that's where Uplink is really interesting to those guys right now, where they're constantly buying more and more encoders. They, you know, those expenses add up, and they're not always running. Sure, at ABC, they probably run more often than not, but they're looking to leverage the cloud and do more scalable encoding, where if they don't need it, they can turn it off. When they do need it, they can turn it on.
Right.
And that's what we're doing with Uplink.
So what is Uplink exactly?
Uplink is a stream media service. So we basically provide content providers such as, you know, publishers like ABC, like Fox, like Discovery Channel. We provide them the tools to be able to send their media safely and encrypted into the cloud, get it encoded, and then play back super high quality to multiple devices. So we leverage HLS, knowing Steve Jobs isn't going to let any other video protocol onto his devices. We started there because everybody wants to be on iOS.
Right.
We now play back. We've got some. We've got a Flash player that will play HLS back. We're really encouraged by all the smart TVs and even the Android tablets with Honeycomb that are now supporting HLS natively. Mm-hmm. We can really reach the full gamut of devices that people want to watch video on. In addition to that, publishers are looking to, they have to report to advertisers how much video is playing back, how popular episodes are, so that they can get top dollar for their advertisements.
Right.
Or to be able to charge a subscription, right? So the analytics side of that is very important. And currently, with all the different providers that these guys have for their different devices, for example, Netflix does 27 encodes, the last I heard, to reach all of the devices that they want to reach. Uh-huh. The reporting on that is a mess. So Uplink also aggregates all the reporting across all the devices, which publishers love. They hate having to aggregate those numbers for their executives.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, just for my deal, I have, let's see, I have four or five shows. Let me see. I have the screencasts. I have this podcast. I have the Rails Coach podcast, the Intentional Excellence podcast, and the Ruby Rogues podcast. So that's five.
Yeah.
And just aggregating data for any of those where I have to go and look at how many downloads I've had, how many page views I've had, and any other statistics that I want. I mean, how many subscribers I have on FeedBurner and all that. I mean, I have to go to three or four places just to do that. So I can only imagine if they have 27 encodes that are being served up by who knows how many providers. Yeah.
Yep. You got it.
Headacheville.
You got it. So that's definitely a big pain point that we're helping to solve for them.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool. So how did you wind up going from a company that I guess does custom iOS development to a company that provides this infrastructure and has a product to sell? And how has that changed your company?
Great question. So last year we were at WWDC and we were invited to sit down with the QuickTime engineers that created the spec for HLS, which was a super opportunity for us to be able to ask some of the questions and get a little bit of insight into the roadmap. Yeah, I'm sure you're familiar with Apple. They their favorite sentence is, "We're not announcing any new products at this time." but it was a chance to sit down with these guys and say, you know, ask some tough questions. And I think we made them slightly uncomfortable because of our background. HLS is heavily, heavily based off of what we did at Move Networks.
Uh-huh.
And when we sat down with them, we were actually introduced as former Move Networks guys. You know, and they play it cool. They that's their job, right?
Right.
But we asked them some pretty tough questions about some pretty tough concerns we had, some problems that we solved at Move that were super critical, and they just kind of grazed over them and blew past them. You know, I'm trying to think of certain examples. It's like you have these chunks, right? And they're usually 2 seconds, and Apple suggests that they should be 10 seconds. Well, the trouble is when your user or your viewer seeks into the middle of one of those segments, jumping into the middle of those slices and trying to start video there can be pretty tricky. And they didn't have any great answers for us. But so it's kind of fun to see them squirm. But to answer your question or get back on track here, I asked them a pretty specific business question about HLS and their goals for it. And that question was, when would we see parity on all of the desktop platforms so that HLS would play back natively in QuickTime, you know, QuickTime for Windows, all of those different places.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of brushed me off and just kind of looked at me and said, "Well, have you read the spec? It's an open spec. Feel free to go write your own player." Well, I kind of did one of these slideways glances at Dave, my partner, and then I looked at my guys, and I see them licking their chops. And we looked back at them and gave them a look of like, well, we're going to go do that. So we started right then. We started disassembling HLS. It's an open spec. We're uh-huh. dealing with MPEG-2 transport stream or MPEG, well, transport stream. And we were dissecting down to the MPEG-4 parts, the H.264 and the AAC. And we came up with a pretty ingenious way of going about playing this back that we quickly threw a patent around and started going to town on. And that's, we figured out how to play it back in Flash. So not only did we get parity on the desktops, but we brought Linux into the fold as well. And then essentially any platform that supports a Flash runtime will potentially be able to play back the video and stream it. So we're reaching a lot of places with HLS now, a lot of devices that formerly, frankly, Apple didn't even care to bother about supporting. Mm-hmm. So. We're pretty excited about that. So we talked to some of our friends in LA about it and said, "Hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could do X?" And they're like, "Yeah, that would be awesome." Well, in October, we gave them a demo. November, we decided, yeah, let's put a company together around this to push it a little bit. And that was when we officially organized Uplink and started going after it. Uh-huh. So since then, it definitely has changed the company. Previously we had a model of working with equity plays, doing some work for sweat equity and taking a piece of the action. It's a different world when you actually have your own idea and you're starting to get some traction around it. CES and the National Association of Broadcasters trade shows were huge for us as we started spreading the news about Uplink, and we've got quite a bit of interest in the company, both from investment as well as from the business side. So it's been going well. We've done a lot of internal funding of the company. So Protoven will actually pay our guys to work on Uplink right now. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to change that with a funding deal that we've got in the works.
Oh, interesting. So you're actually seeking funding now.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. We're raising a little bit of capital. It's based off of a large customer that would like to use the service, and we're not giving up equity at this point. They're basically buying down or buying a discount, a perpetual discount for this investment money.
Oh, interesting. That's a really fascinating way to do it, I think. I mean, I hear about all these other venture companies that they raise money, and then when things get a little bit rocky, then what happens? Well, those guys own most of your company now, so they just go, you and you, see ya.
Yep.
It's our toy now. And you're just like, wait a minute, this is my baby.
Yeah, that's definitely the game, right? I mean, I commended the guys at Move Networks for being able to raise money in their follow-on Series B round without giving up a board seat. I thought that was just miraculous, yeah, just from where I'd come from. But now to be able to raise funding, I think I've one-upped them now that I'm raising funding and I'm not even giving up a share of equity, you know. So, but it's definitely unconventional. We're hoping it will go well. There's definitely light at the end of the tunnel in our model, so that as we get closer to the end of that funding, the services that we'll currently be running will be able to outrun that. So we won't need any extra capital.
That makes sense. So I would be remiss with the audience that I have for this podcast in particular if I didn't dig into some of the technical details.
Now let's do it.
So I want to get into the encoding a little bit. How many formats do you encode video and audio into?
Just one.
Really?
Yes.
And so then how do you make it available to all of these different devices?
So for the players, some devices support it natively. For example, your Rokus, like Honeycomb, and of course iOS devices, the iPhone and the iPad, they'll play back this HLS format natively.
So is HLS not MPEG-4 or whatever? Is it its own thing?
It is. It's a way of preparing it into these slices, or these TS stream, or slice files, I guess, or whatever, segments. So the audio's AAC, the video's H.264 encoded.
Okay. So what's the difference between, and this is a question that I probably should know the answer to, but don't. What's the difference between H.264 and MPEG-4 or MPEG-2 or whatever?
So the MPEGs are like the container that they live in, and the wrapper around the encode, so.
Okay. So you have H.264 video with AAC audio, and then you just feed it out to these devices. What do you do for the devices that don't support it natively and maybe don't support Flash? Then what do you do?
Then hopefully they've got an SDK that's great to use, and we'll build a player for it. That's sort of our target. And we're talking, for an example, one of where we might do that is with like a smart TV. We'll go to an LG or a Samsung or Vizio and say, okay, you have hardware chips, you know, that already support HLS, give us a toolkit and we'll build an application. We'll build the smart app, the Uplink smart app. So our customers, we would provide that SDK to our customers. So our customers would come to us and say, we want to be on the Samsung. So we would give them the Uplink SDK that works with the Samsung TV, for example, uh-huh. and they would build their own app, or we would essentially help them build their app. And then it just shows up on the Samsung TV and they'll be able to play back that particular customer's content.
Okay. And another thing that I see coming up here, you know, especially with some of these networks that make tons and tons of hours of shows, is storage. Is that a problem that you've had to solve? And how do you deal with storage and load balancing if you have lots of people watching stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. I should have mentioned it earlier because it's really an essential part of our strategy as well. With one encode, obviously, you're not having to store 27 versions of a file.
That'd be nice.
So we definitely help our customers with their storage needs and the storage problems. What goes along with that is the management of it, cleaning them up, deleting them, moving them around when you need to, that sort of stuff. Currently for storage, we're big fans of Amazon, so we store everything in S3, and we're currently serving a lot of it out of CloudFront, or we'll have CloudFront Origin for, you know, your Akamai's, your Limelight's, your Level 3's, those mm-hmm. types of guys, these CDN networks.
Okay, and we've heard some rumors about Amazon lately, about, you know, some of these servers going down and some of their other services going down. Obviously, it wasn't everything. Did that affect you guys at all?
No, it didn't, luckily. We're pretty cloud agnostic. So when we detect, we monitor our encoders and our services boxes, which live out in the cloud fairly closely. We always maintain a redundant set in other clouds. For example, we use Rackspace. Verizon just bought one of the customer, or a huge data center that we're a customer of called Terramark. There's another company, TierPoint, based out of Seattle, Spokane area, that we've used. These guys provide either VMware clouds or Zen-based clouds, and we run phenomenally well in those clouds. So when Amazon had their little hiccup, we just switched everybody over to Rackspace fairly quickly and didn't see any interruption in service whatsoever.
Wow, I bet your customers love that too.
Yeah, definitely. You know, in our model where we're looking at the next big thing that we're going to be pushing out is a live linear model of broadcast, almost mm-hmm. similar to turning on your TV and just watching whatever channel you want. In that scenario, you really can't afford some downtime because that becomes dead air and that becomes right. super expensive. So we tiptoed around SLAs, but the fact of the matter is these big providers, these big networks demand them. Uh-huh. So we've put in that extra effort to make everything redundant so that we don't have that downtime.
Right. Well, if you've tiptoed around SLAs, you still have the SLA of we didn't maintain the uptime, so you're leaving.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, that, yes, definitely.
So yeah, I mean, I can see either way you have to maintain a certain level of reliability, and it sounds like you guys have pretty well hit it. So how do you monitor things between Amazon and Rackspace to know if there is a hiccup and when you need to switch over, and what do you do when that happens? Is it automated or do you have to actually go in and push a button?
Yeah, the actual scaling of it is automated. The watching of it is done outside of those networks. So we do a little bit of monitoring inside and we leverage some of the tools that Amazon provides us, mm-hmm. but most of it is done outside of the cloud. So we'll, or from a different cloud, you know, and it's a variety of home-baked tools that watch different services in particular, as well as Nagios.
Right. Nagios, my old nemesis.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
You could do hot configs on that thing. I hate bouncing it to get stuff to come up, but
yeah, I used to be a systems administrator, and before that, I worked in an operations center that used it, and yeah, it was obnoxious at best.
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, so another question that's not really related to anything is there's a flag behind you to your left.
Yes.
What country is that, and what's your relation to that? I'm just curious.
That is the flag of Spain, and I am celebrating the opening of a new Apple store in Madrid. No, I'm kidding. I served a mission for the LDS Church in Seville. Oh, okay. So it's just my memento.
Yeah, I hear that. I served an LDS mission in Padova, Italy.
So. Oh, cool. Yeah, and we were neighbors then.
Yeah, pretty close. But anyway, so I had another question I was going to ask, and I got sidetracked by your flag.
Well, to dive maybe even more technical into it, I know a lot of your viewers are Ruby guys.
Yes.
We are Python guys. It's just a history that we've had. For example, Dave Bruick, our main chief architect, and he's now the CTO of Uplink, wrote the Python Bible back in the day and for 2.1. And we've had a big history with Python, but we feel like kindred spirits to the Ruby guys for sure. I'm friends with a guy named Josh Knowles, runs the Gotham Ruby group. And he's done work with RSpec, I believe, and some other things. I haven't followed him that closely, but he's at Pivotal Labs now in New York City and is one of their directors. But yeah, we're one of those guys that kind of sit back and watch the battle broil and take the perspective of these are both tools that are getting a lot of cool things written in and are similar enough that if Python died tomorrow, I'd jump right to Ruby or vice versa, I'm sure, with you guys. So,
right. So do you do the backend development or strictly iOS or both or?
Yeah. So, for example, in our content management system, it's Django based. While we use SDB on the backend, we don't use the Django ORM to manage that. We like the front end. We like the templating engine that it gives us and have leveraged that. And for local storage, we will use Django's ORM and a SQL database. We also like the Memcache integration and being able to use Memcache with some of the other services that go on in the box. So, so that's a lot of the back end stuff, all the deployment scripts, et cetera. Fabric, we use Fabric quite a bit. And then homegrown Python stuff to do all of our deployment.
Oh, interesting. So, which SQL database are you using? I'm a little curious.
We're Postgres guys.
Postgres.
Yep.
Yeah, I've had a few people jump on me for still sticking with MySQL, but I've just been too lazy to switch. And what do you find that the advantages are for using Postgres over MySQL or some of the other options that you have out there?
For us, it was passing more ACID tests back when we chose it. I think today it's more familiarity. It doesn't hurt that you'll see things like Oracle buying up Sun and putting...
Yeah, that freaked me out.
As it did for us. No, we don't use MySQL that much, but it definitely casts a shadow on its future, right? So, yeah. Mostly the ACID testing and that support that was what we were looking for. Something that more closely mimicked perhaps what an enterprise quality database like Oracle would do. So
that makes sense. Now, I have another question. First of all, I haven't seen you at the Cocoa Heads meetings up in Salt Lake. Do you go to many users groups or do you just too busy?
I try to every once in a while hit them. Like, I'm fairly active in the Django users group.
Okay. I didn't know one existed out here.
Yes, one exists. You should attend just to meet the guys because there's some great guys there.
I think I ought to.
I don't know. Do you know Guy Harding, perhaps? Guy's one of, he's very active in not only LaunchUp, but in the Django user group. But yeah, I would love to attend the Cocoa Heads. I'm on the BYU Cocoa Heads mailing list, mostly as a recruiter, so I don't know how liked I am down there. But but yeah, I'll definitely drop by.
Well, I'm on that list too. I'll flame you sometime.
Great.
Interesting. So my other question is I'm a pretty new iOS developer. I mean, I picked up a couple of books. I actually convinced a publisher to send me a couple of books.
Awesome.
But anyway, I picked up a couple of books. I've been working my way through one of them. Yeah, I've got it right here. It's the iPhone Programming, the Big Nerd Ranch Guide. It's pretty good, but...
I love Hillegas stuff. That's really where I started with my Cocoa work back in the day when I was just desktop. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of the ranch.
Yeah, my question is what recommendations do you have for people who are just getting started with, I guess, with iPhone development, and then I'll ask you again for programming in general.
Sure. I'm a big Pragmatic Programmer fan. Mm-hmm. And I've been following Dave and Andy and what they've been doing with pragprog.com for quite a while. So I always go there first. And Bill Dudney is currently the iOS evangelist, I believe. And he's written a book or a couple of books for pragprog. I think it's the iPhone SDK. And then he's done, I think, a core animation book or a couple of others. But Prag Prog has a couple of those titles that are great. Coincidentally, the guy I think Bill replaced at Apple was a guy named Matt Drance. And Matt is the developer behind the TED application for the iPad. He was formerly, like I said, an evangelist. And he really impressed me at WWDC. It would have been 2009, I think. Because this guy did like 6 or 7 sessions himself, if not more, and just knew his stuff down pat. I mean, fielded questions, and just, he was a phenomenal speaker. Well, that's translated into his writing as well. And he's got a book over at Prag Prog. I hope he's writing more, because they're just great. So I send people to Prag Prog and say, pick up any title that's got an apple on the cover. You're not going to go wrong.
Good stuff. I've actually talked to both Dave and Andy on this podcast. So.
Oh, great.
So
I've got an old, what is it? Agile Web Development on Rails book.
Yeah, I have the ebook. I don't have the actual hard, or do I?
But I've got their signatures on the front cover. And the other day, Dave on Twitter, because I follow him on Twitter, and I sent a picture of it, and I said, is this legitimate? Is this really your signature? And he's like, yep, those are the real deal. First edition or something, I don't know, but that's kind of fun.
Yeah, I have the 4th edition on my Kindle app on iPad.
I'm sure it's more relevant than mine at this point.
Probably. Yeah, things are changing pretty fast in the Rails world, so... Yeah, and they just released the latest iteration of the Ruby Pickaxe book. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. I picked that up at Ruby Conference last year. They had a sale through the whole conference. It was like $10 for the copy. Nice. So I spent $10 for the electronic copy and $10 for the hard copy. I was like,
there you go.
Cool.
Hey, there's something about being able to carry a bunch of books around on an iPad, you know, and just pull them out, or a Kindle or whatever you've got. I really enjoy that. My bookshelf is starting to dwindle.
I need a new one because I'm running out of space. But anyway, it's been really, really fun to talk to you. Oh, I did want to ask you one last question, and this is something that I try and ask everybody, and I don't usually forget, but anyway, you hired programmers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you look for when you're hiring a programmer? What makes a good developer? And how do you recognize them?
Interesting question. I think what makes a good programmer is somebody who isn't afraid to dig into code. They're somebody that they've got a breadth of knowledge that allows them to look at the big picture. Where is this code going to be in 6 months from now? What help would a comment right here be? What is going to get this application out the door the fastest without severely impacting maintenance down the road? I like to think of that as sort of an architectural nod to writing code.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a Yagmi fan. You aren't going to need it. But it makes sense to know where an app is going, or what the roadmap looks like, or pay attention to what other pieces are going to be integrated with that system. In the the ecosystem that we've built around Uplink, that's a crucial piece. We have so many different systems that are interacting, from the client requesting things from the services to those services interacting with encoders. It can be a tricky orchestra to try to conduct at times. So being able to find guys that can communicate well with each other in a team format is crucial. I know super smart guys that love to just silo themselves, you know, and if you've got one piece that just lives on its own, they're the guys to write. But for us, you know, it's even doubly hard as we're all working virtually from homes and, you know, get together a couple times a month. But keeping those open lines of communication, reaching out to each other, asking for someone that's going to ask for help before too much time is spent, when they know that perhaps Dave or myself can jump in and answer a question, or one of the other guys. I think that's crucial. Someone who can communicate well.
That makes sense. Sounds good. Well, I don't have any other questions for you, except if people want to follow what you're doing or see what you're thinking about, what's the best place to go do that?
Follow me on Twitter. I'm not too crazy, so the load is pretty light at tby. And then my blog's blog.tby.com, and it should be a lot more active here in the coming weeks as I can talk more about what we're doing at Uplink.
All right. And tby is T-B-Y-E.
That is correct.
All right. Well, thanks again, Tyler. It was good to talk to you, and you know, it's always fun to see you at the launch ups and stuff.
Hey, likewise. Thanks so much.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
All right. Well, I just want to thank Tyler for coming onto the podcast back on. There was some awesome stuff there. I think there were some really great things shared, and you know, hopefully anyone who's interested in video or iOS development, or you know, even some of the back end stuff that we talked about, you know, if you're interested in any of that, he's a very approachable guy, and you know, you can reach out to him. It just a fun and interesting thing to talk about, and you know, like I said before, and I was going to ask him about it on the podcast, and I realized that I didn't. But yeah, Steve Jobs saw his application and basically said, this is what I had in mind for the iPad. So, I mean, I can only imagine how happy that makes people. But anyway, you know, just an excellent guy. He, like I said, he's local here, so it should be interesting to see where it goes. But anyway, and I'll see if I can make it out to a Django group and see what that's all about. Anyway, I want to thank our sponsor again, NewRelic.com. New Relic, thank you so much for sponsoring the podcast and helping us get the word out. I also want to let you know that if you are looking for Ruby or Ruby on Rails help, you can contact me. My phone number is 801-367-6164. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/CMAXW. That's C-Max-W. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/CharlesMaxWood. And, you know, just a lot of stuff going on here. They're probably going to be working on a few products of my own. And, you know, hopefully can get the word out and get those out. So anyway, if you have any other questions, you want to learn Rails, anything like that, then by all means, contact me, chuck@teachmetocode.com, or by any of the other ways that I mentioned before. And finally, I want to just encourage you to go out there, write some great stuff, and remember that writing the code is the easy part.